Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Hypergrowth Podcast. My name is Soham Moore.
And I'm Nikhil Bose. We've built this podcast with the goal of talking to a variety of individuals whom have created a unique set of mental models in which they make sense of the world. Our goal is to unpack and share these insights.
Every data point has a name.
In today's episode, we're incredibly excited to talk with DJ Patil, a true thought leader and someone who's on the forefront of the data revolution. He's most famously known as the outspoken former U.S. chief data scientist under President Obama, but has also held important data-focused roles at LinkedIn, Greylock, eBay, and now a healthcare startup called Devoted Health. His path to becoming a pioneer within the data science community didn't come easy and was by no means conventional. Patil grew up, like the both of us, in the Bay Area, but struggled in high school and was, quote, very bad at math, in his own words. This is crazy to think about, considering he later became a PhD in mathematics and a leader in one of the most technically rigorous fields. He talks about how he found his specific passion right here.
You know, the big shift, I think, for me, where actually I could see stuff coming together was fundamentally through physics, actually. So oddly enough, even when I got to UCSD, I took the 4 series of physics. So that's like the, you know, the one for majors. And the reason I took it was my view was of any class that you take in college, you should always try to take the hardest version of it. Because if you're the part of the reason rationale of it is all the best students are there. And so all your colleagues and people that are going to be around you are the best. It's kind of like, you know, the analogy of playing sports, you would always sign up to go play with the best sports people or the best sports team, because that's where you're going to learn about all the cool stuff and skills that they have. So it was the same way for me. But part of the thing was like, oh, wow, this math can actually help me see how the world works. You know, it could be totally something very simple that, you know, you do these kind of classic physics equations of like, if a bullet is fired into a block of ice, how much ice melts because of the kinetic energy how does that kinetic energy actually get displaced in terms of energy in the ice block? So I just thought that was just fascinating, that I was like, you can actually figure that out, and then you could figure out and you could build on that to understand the world in other ways. And that was kind of the aha moment for me in many ways, was like, oh, this is something that helps me understand the world in a way that I can take a set of tools and understand pretty much almost everything about the physical world.
As Nikhil mentioned, DJ did his PhD in the University of Maryland, where he found refuge in one of the more obscure branches of mathematics, chaos theory.
It actually brings together almost a wider array of things than appears on the surface. And much of this, what you're talking about is these things are not only complex, but the degree of complexity is one that is mind-bogglingly hard to get our minds really wrapped around. And you think about it as, you know, the classic, whether it's, you know, you're connected to some arbitrary person on the planet by just a few degrees of freedom, meaning that, you know, if you knew somebody who knew somebody who knew somebody, you could get to anybody in the world. To the idea that a butterfly flapping its wings in one part of the world could cause a storm in some other place, or that there are these kind of weird statistical phenomena of very extreme outlier events. The mathematics of these actually tie together everything from deep, rich probability to physics. And some of this stems way back there, and it goes back to this original prize that was going to be given out, a math prize, for the person that could help figure out if the solar system was stable, meaning like, is the Earth going to go careening into Mars, or is Jupiter going to kind of fall out of its orbit and take out other planets? And that was the problem of the day. And so a very famous mathematician named Henri Poincaré reduced the problem to what's called the three-body problem. And it's basically take two planets and a small satellite and then try to figure out what are all the weird behaviors could happen? How do they orbit? And it turns out it's mind-bogglingly complex. I mean, it's just unbelievable how bizarre it is. And this is the beginnings of where chaos theory started to show up, and people realize, like, oh, wow, we can't really do much more of this with the traditional mathematics. And it turned out until almost 200 years later, when computers were able to be there, that you could start to see the differences. And in that same way, the way we look at data sources, the way we look at math and statistics and probability and try to assess what's going on, we're still in the very early phase. The early phase of being able to kind of say, how do we actually think about not only the math, but how do we think about the ways of collecting data?
The degree of complexity in reality is absolutely insane, and sometimes that idea escapes us. Take the smartphone you're using to listen to this podcast, for example. There's a variety of reasons why it exists than what meets the eye. More than just the fact that it is a physical gray or black box, it works because of an intricate ecosystem of other technologies that are at play. The hardware that powers it, the software that runs on it, and even more high level, the political and economic systems in the United States that allow us to run a reliable electrical grid. As we continue to build technologies on top of other technologies, we enter a universe of exponentially increasing complexity. And what chaos theory shares with us is that if the initial conditions of a chaotic system were changed microscopically over a long period of time, the outcome of the whole system will be completely different.
It was this foray into chaos theory that gave DJ a chance to work with computationally rigorous data, an opportunity that later gave birth to his expertise in a novel field, data science. If you look at this 15 or 20 years ago, data was almost a needless entity. Now, with the advent of data science, it has become one of the most prized commodities, viewed as the new electricity by some. The concept of data science itself has been a sort of an enigma, with many universities, companies, and institutions failing to find a proper definition. The simplest way to put it is that data science is concerned with drawing useful and valid conclusions from data. The first domain to rigorously use data science was online ads. And even to this day, some of our brightest data scientists focus their work on delivering personal ads to you, as they understand how you surf the web. It's been the fundamental business model of tech giants such as Google and Facebook. Since then, data science has been regarded as the sexiest job of the 21st century, and I'm sure you've heard many claims about data like the following.
Big data is going to transform how we live, how we work, and how we think.
DJ, however, has championed the use of data in a different domain. Through his role as the inaugural Chief White House Data Scientist, he has pushed for data's use in societal and civic causes. Here, he talks about the value that data brings to the public sphere.
Well, the first one I think that's there, that's incredibly powerful, is what does it mean to have transparency into a system? You know, take our healthcare system. When you go in to get a treatment, you have no idea what's going to cost. Now, a lot of times you don't need to know because there's insurance company is going to pay for it or something else is going to happen. But there's a lot of people who can't pay. And so that lack of transparency actually disproportionately hurts the whole system. But we can look at all sorts of other places, which is we don't actually have transparency into something like how often are people stopped by their local police department? And what is the change or the rate of a black person being stopped versus somebody else? There was a great graph that somebody showed me where they actually pulled and were able to figure out this data from a city, a small town, actually. And what they were able to show is that the stop rates between whites and blacks in this town were roughly the same. And this is for a number of years. But then when you look at the search rates of who's being searched, being black meant you were going to be searched at something like 10 times the amount. It was it was unbelievable. And then you kind of ask that question underneath that of who is being searched and why are they being searched? And you can see that a lot of these searches are all tied to a small number of officers. And you kind of go, well, are these officers, maybe they work in only one place, or they only work in a neighborhood that is predominantly Black. And that turns out is not the case. And so you kind of pull one argument out after another, and you realize we have a bias problem in here. Transparency allows you to not only see it, but it allows you then to really try to start asking these harder questions about what do we want to do with it. When you open up that data and you allow others to innovate on top of that data, that's when really remarkable things start to happen.
But in recent times, data has been blamed by the media to have caused issues that we've all heard of today regarding privacy and ethics. Facebook's Cambridge Analytica scandal was the tipping point that has led to greater public scrutiny in how we use and collect data. DJ outlines his suggestions for ethics in the field.
This is the problem, I think, that we need to address right now. What does it mean to use data for good? What does it mean to use data in ways that are harmful? We wrote, the White House under President Obama wrote four big data reports, if you will. The third one was on the aspects of both potential good and harm. And it was kind of highlighted areas where there's great opportunity. And take, for example, in the criminal justice system, bail. The way people are assigned bail, there's a deep bias that is inherent in the system. We know that people, depending on how hungry you are or time of day, there's a bias actually in there of the type of sentence that you give. And so people have tried to build some of these bail calculators. Unfortunately, some of these bail calculators are even more racist than people. There's also bail calculators that highlight when there is bias. And so a lot of this comes down to is, how do we have safeguards to do this? And so to do that, we published the beginnings of what we're calling an open source book. And this is being released right now, and the first three chapters are out. The fourth one comes out next week, and then it's going to go online, freely downloadable, and anybody can add a chapter. We're going to put it on GitHub. And it kind of goes through an argument of why we need a radically different approach. And one side of that, we could be maybe all of us that are working in data need to take an oath. But another side might be maybe we all need a checklist that we have to have when we build something with data. And then we talk about that checklist, just like the same way like physicians or a surgeon has a checklist before they do a surgery. And these have been incredible in reducing deaths in the hospital. But maybe we need more. I mean, we need other principles, something that we call the five C's, like how do you have control? How do you have clarity of what's being done with the data? What does it mean to have consistency in the use of data? How do we start building out the safeguards? But there's also a cultural aspect of how do we do this? What if every person that was being interviewed was around data or technology was asked an ethics question? How would you do this? What happens? Let me give you a very specific one. You're building a model, and you're not supposed to use race, but you find race as a proxy. What do you do? Talk to us about your next steps. Maybe if every person who is being interviewed, when they said, "Do you have any questions for us?" they asked, "How do you handle ethical issues? Do you have a way of having a dissent channel?" That maybe this goes to some type of central ombudsman, maybe goes straight to the CEO, maybe goes to some compliance officer, depending on the field. And they have the ability to help you think about these problems or correct something if something goes wrong. Maybe it's an outside entity. That's what's going to start shifting the tenor of and addressing the potential of technologies doing harm. Because it's already happening today. It's not a theoretical. And these things have to be very heavily done in partnership. If the government just tries to do it, it tends to not be agile enough. It doesn't quite always work. And then this other side of it is, if industry just does it on its own, it also tends to not work because it often benefits only a few. It doesn't benefit everybody. And we've seen this play out time and time again in a number of other spaces. Part of the reason the modern FDA was created is because people were being given these magic Ixlers, you know, these kind of drinking kind of potions, if you, back then, of and I was like, hey, this will make you healthy. And they poisoned a lot of people. I think it was like, you know, seven people just died from this kind of small, this kind of small batch that somebody was producing. And it turned out it wasn't illegal to poison people. And there was no way to ensure a safeguard of medical, you know, medicines or anything around that. And so the FDA was created. The same reason there's regulation in the hospitals around clinical trials and all these other things. And the same has happened around nuclear technology. Now, how do we do that appropriately, given the speed at which technology is being changing? That's something that we have to open up and figure out. But let's also not forget, where has the AI revolution come from? This has actually been sparked because of government involvement. The military, in particular DARPA, has really funded a tremendous amount of this. The first AI projects were, and many of the continuing ones have been funded by government taxpayer, the U.S. taxpayers through DARPA, including the self-driving car challenge. And that has changed and radically advanced the technologies that we're seeing. And we have to figure out now, how do we make sure that that works and fits in with our society?
Since moonlighting as the world's favorite data scientist, DJ has shifted his focus to solving problems in the healthcare sector through a new startup called Devoted Health.
So why am I so passionate about this? You know, which one of us hasn't had a family member who's gone through some type of medical, you know, thing? You know, it's like whether it could be an accident, it could be cancer, it could be something, you know, you have a medical situation, and then you try to figure out, how do you get the right care? How do you trust the system? And we started with the premise of, what would it be like to have a healthcare system where every person was treated like they were part of your own family? What would that look like? And could you radically change the quality of care as a result? Could you drive down costs in a fundamentally awesome way so that care could be, the notion of care could be changed completely? And so what we decided to do is put many of the people together who've thought some of the most deeply about this in the space. And so we have, you know, Todd Park, who founded Athena Health and Castlight, and two of the largest healthcare companies in the US. And then also was the CTO for not only Health and Human Services in the government, but then was the United States CTO. We have his brother, Ed Park, who was also a founder of Athena. And then we've got you know, people who were on the healthcare rescue team. And so we've kind of put all the people together that we said have done some of this best thinking, and including Bob Kocher, who helped write the Affordable Care Act. And we said, we got to make a go of this. And we got to bring together the top clinicians and everyone to find a new model of this. And what we're finding is that there are phenomenal physicians out there, phenomenal. They're typically referred to as, and these are primary care physicians. And they are your quarterback for your healthcare system. And if you allow them to say, hey, my job is to take care of you, the whole you, not just do some model where I'm a la carte getting paid, but I take care of the whole you, there's an ability to do dramatic improvements in healthcare quality, and everybody wins. And so we're working hard to be that kind of plan, a healthcare plan. And you have to be an insurance company because you have to be a payer, but it's necessary, but not sufficient. So some are calling us a payvidor. So we're both a payer and a provider. We have our own clinicians. Neil Wagley, Dan Blumenthal, who are two of the very outstanding physicians in the country. And we're building out this system. And we're right now in the process of going through all of our regulatory approvals, but we're very excited to start this on this mission by first taking care of American seniors, and making sure that as everybody that has done their service taking parts of different parts of this country, they have the best healthcare at every stage of their life going forward. Where we are seeing change is when you have the data scientists and the practitioners tightly integrated with each other. It can't be just a bunch of data scientists sitting in one room saying, look, I got a massive, big idea and we kind of built it out and then we just hand that solution over. It's almost always the case that they have to be built together. And when they're interwoven like that, really remarkable things happen. An example in policing that happened is we put a team in of data scientists into this town, Charlotte-Mecklenburg County, and the data scientists were doing all the ride-alongs, everything with the police officers. They were like one unified team. And when they were looking at what could be behind when an officer uses excessive use of force, and they started doing feature set selection, that beginning basis for machine learning and AI, they realized that the first set of features are all the usual boring ones. You know, you get lots of accidents, history of complaints, all those things. But in the middle of the feature set shows up two interesting ones. The first being you've responded to a suicide or multiple suicides. And the other one was you've responded to domestic violence where a child is present. And the data scientists in this case were able to figure out right away what's going on. And they were able to say, oh, what's happening is the person responds to this type of thing. It's highly emotionally charged. And then, you know, they may not be the person doing all the paperwork. So they go, dispatch tells them to get back out on the street. And so now they pull somebody over who's broken taillight or something and they're flippant, but this officer hasn't had time to decompress. So where is the failure? Is the failure the officer? Is the technology? Like, why isn't the dispatch system smart enough to know that this officer needs some time to decompress? He or she needs some time to become human again after this highly emotional event. You know, that's the place where we're going to see the change, when we really build with the people. And a lot of times the vendor solution isn't of that approach. And when we adopt that, I think we're going to see net better outcomes.
We have to be cautious here, because the tools in which we use to collect data can come with biases or presuppositions of their own. For example, if I choose to build an app today that helps homeless people find jobs, the app will be built with the current assumption of what homelessness is today, something that is subject to change over time and that is highly dependent on context. Along DJ Patil's journey through tech, government, and healthcare, he's worked with some really incredible people who have provided some valuable advice.
Yeah, I've been really fortunate. And one of the things that I think been true for me is you always seek out the best people that are potentially out there. And if they all have something to share with you, and if you can effectively apprentice with them, they're going to teach you something new. And the best way to get taught something new is to work together on a project, to try to create, try to make something new. So in the case of with Jim York, who is the founder of creator of chaos theory, named the field of chaos theory, we got to try to build scientific results together. Eugenia Kaune, we got to try to figure out how to make a new way of improving weather forecasts. With President Obama, obviously, it was one of how can we fundamentally think about data in a new way to make better the world better for everybody. And the thing I tell people to do is you also don't know who's going to be amazing. But if you start working with them together, maybe you make something even more powerful and unique than you would have by yourself. And that's one of the greatest things that anybody from college has the opportunity to do, is you just get to work with so many cool people and you get to meet so many amazing people. The biggest mistake that you can make is not staying in touch with them. By building out your social network and your collaboration network, you're going to find yourselves in a position where you're able to just have amazing people around you. And you'll be around even more amazing people as time goes on. Every single one of them has taught me so much in so many different ways. Jim York used to give me these problems of that seem super easy on the surface and so unbelievably difficult to when you really start thinking about them. And you know, the classic obviously is like you can take something simple like the Zeno's paradox, which says if there's a wall in front of you and you cover half the distance each time, do you ever actually touch the wall? Because you go half the distance again, and then half the distance between that. Do you ever touch the wall? And then how do you think about those things? Now, that's a well talked about one, but there's so many others. President Obama gave me some phenomenal advice at one point where when we were thinking about building out the precision medicine initiative, and this is the idea of how do we really enable a world where we have tailored medical treatments for everybody. And he said, you know, every data point has a name. You need to make sure that those names are at the table. Those people are at the table when you're building this system. You can't do this and then go to them. You have to do it with them. And, you know, at first I didn't fully appreciate how rich and how difficult that is, because the first time we really sat down with people in the community, we said, here's what we're thinking. And then we were just like, that's not interesting. And in fact, in some ways had some deeply problematic areas. And when we switched that around and we really started building with people, we came up with a phenomenally more powerful approach because it was a we approach. And I think that's what President Obama saw that we couldn't, is that you need a much bigger we approach when you're building something big. And that's something I think a lot of the companies are struggling with right now, is that they take an approach that is really a few people building these things, and they've been fortunate enough to scale very effectively, but they're not fundamentally a we approach. I mean, look at what you see this all the time on a college campus, that there's decisions made, but it doesn't always reflect the benefits of all the entire student body. In the same way, right now we're having a discussion here in the U.S. about what does it mean as for immigrants, and what is the superpower of the nation? And one of the powerful aspects just comes from the founding documents of the United States, which is we the people. And that we has been our superpower. And undermining that is, I think we're starting to see the impact of what happens when we undermine or we question what does we mean.
We end our conversation with DJ imparting one final piece of advice.
You know, the number one advice I think I fundamentally have for people is you gotta like find your tribe, find the people that will push you forward, find the people that are going to challenge you every day. They're the people that are going to kick your butt every day. They're going to make you laugh. They're going to make you cry. They're going to be there for you, but they're going to push you to be better. And I have been so incredibly fortunate that it wasn't just people like President Obama, but it was Dennis McDonough, his chief of staff, Secretary of Defense Ash Carter, Valerie Jarrett. I mean, all these people kicked my butt every day to be better, to do better work, to push more. And my wife and kids, too. They were like, aren't you supposed to be doing better? And find your tribe that's going to do that for you. And have fun with that. It's got to be fun. But if they come together, they will be your superpower that will carry you forward through the darkest times.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Hypergrowth, where we talked data with one of the most interesting people in the industry. Because we're at such a pivotal time in history, the next couple of years will be filled with data this and data that, and most of it will be truly helpful. But at the same time, we must be careful to not only collect data in masses, but to also understand its context. Behind every single digit and decimal point lies a real and incredibly complex physical entity. And it's up to us to dictate how this technology will go. Let's just make sure we don't forget people in this equation.